Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Tuesday evening Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on December 18, 2018. My talk and our Sangha discussion is the second of two talks on the Dhatu Vibhanga Sutta. This sutta shows the Buddha's view on the complete and impersonal ordinariness of human life and what actually constitutes a self. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. So tonight's the second part of this Dhatu Vibhanga Sutta, where the Buddha is describing the completely impersonal and ordinariness of what constitutes a person, what constitutes a human being. And as in everything the Buddha taught, it relates to and is in the context of dependent origination and Four Noble Truths. And I can't remember if I did this the first talk. I think I did last Tuesday, though. Just to review dependent origination, because there's such a tight reference that it's important to see that. Dependent origination is what the Buddha awakened to. And he awakened to the fact that ignorance of the way things are, ignorance of Four Noble Truths, leads to fabrication. And just to qualify this, the Buddha's, this isn't a creation myth as dependent origination is often presented as. It doesn't describe an environment where we are all interdependent of all phenomena, or we interbe or interconnected, or there's some grand singular unifying cosmic consciousness. All of that may or may not be true. It's irrelevant to the Buddha's Dhamma. From ignorance of these Four Noble Truths, we create a fabricated or corrupted or perverted or distorted view of ourselves in relation to the world. It has nothing to do with creation. It has to do with what we're giving birth to in each moment, rooted in ignorance. And anything that is rooted in ignorance is prone to confusion, delusion, and suffering. From ignorance comes fabrications. From fabrications, as a requisite condition, comes consciousness. Consciousness, in this sense, is simply ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance and informed by a fabricated view of all things, by the way. It's not just the Dhamma, but it's our life and who we are. From consciousness as a requisite condition comes name and form. The Pali word is namarupa. It simply means just that. I've given a name to this form, and it's me. And now I've identified myself as this being, but my view is rooted in what? Ignorance. And so my view is fabricated. I've created a fabricated view of myself that is constantly prone to a disappointing experience. And that could be extreme suffering. It could just be ongoing stress based in that ignorance leading to the fabrications. From name and form, from self-referential views, from self-identification with phenomena, comes the sixth sense base. And again, notice the progression. It's not a creation myth. We're not trying to describe how a human being is formed. But in this process, from rooted in ignorance, my views of myself in relation to the world are fabricated, they're corrupted, they're perverted. And now, through self-identification, as I come in contact with the world through the sixth sense base, I'm interpreting my experience from what? From a fabricated view. From the sixth sense base comes contact. Makes sense, doesn't it? As a human being, as a person, there has to be a vehicle for me to interact with my environment. It's the sixth sense, the five physical senses and the sixth sense of that consciousness rooted in ignorance. From the sixth sense base comes feeling. Right? Without the six senses, there's no feeling. I'm sorry. I missed that, didn't I? From the sixth sense base comes contact. Thank you. And from contact, as a requisite condition, comes feeling. Again, it makes sense. If I didn't have any senses, if I didn't have any way of interacting with the world, there'd be no existence, and there certainly wouldn't be anything to react to or respond to. But there is. And again, where this came from, where it's going, is of no value in developing the Dhamma. The Buddha is entirely practical in what he's teaching. This is simply what is. From contact comes feeling. That contact, I'm interpreting that contact and the feeling from ignorance and a fabricated view. From feeling as a requisite condition comes craving. Now that I've established myself and I'm feeling something, good or bad or indifference, and I'm creating an identity over these feelings and these fabricated views, I'm deciding what I need in this world to be happy, safe, and secure, and what I need to be, what I need to avoid to continue that happiness. But what is that view rooted in? It's a fabricated view. I'm sorry.
I said ignorance.
Thank you. From craving comes clinging and maintaining. Once I've identified something as me or that I need, I've self-identified with it, I am compulsed to cling to it because I've created an identity by it. There's nothing outside of me working on me, by the way, in this process. It's not because I did something wrong. It's not because a creator God forgot about me for a moment. What's happening is my mind is rooted in ignorance. I'm simply misunderstanding what's occurring to me, mm-hmm. and who I am within that. And so anything that follows is a misunderstanding. It's lacking wisdom of the way things are. And I thought about what you said last week, Helen, about compassion, etc. And there's more to it. And if I get to it tonight, I'll add to it. But if not, please bring it up again because it relates to this. But it's a long sutta. From clinging and maintaining comes becoming. There's never a qualifier or a modifier after that. And the question often is becoming what? And some of the answers are really nonsensical unless you keep it in the context of what the Buddha is teaching. From ignorance leads to clinging and maintaining. From clinging and maintaining leads to becoming further ignorant unless something interrupts this process. From becoming comes birth. And again, it's not a creation myth. In the context, what are we giving birth to? Another moment rooted in ignorance. That's 99% of the understanding of rebirth that we need to be concerned with. There's 1% that's a little bit more than that. From birth as a requisite condition comes, I won't go through the whole list, the whole entire mass of confusion, deluded thinking, and ongoing suffering. That's dependent origination. From ignorance comes suffering. Saturday I read the Mula Sutta because it relates directly to this. I'm not going to read the entire sutta, but it's in that talk. But just the Mula Sutta is part of the three talk and three article series on the meaning of becoming. It's in the book. We go over it on retreat. This is from the Mula Sutta where the Buddha is describing how impersonal and impermanent phenomena come into be and how it causes stress and suffering because of a misunderstanding. But the only one line is about, I think it's a 16-line sutta, short, but I only want to read one line. All phenomena have mindfulness as their governing principle. So it points directly to how the Buddha taught mindfulness, which is a very refined type of mindfulness. It's mindfulness that is rooted in concentration, right meditation practice, that holds in mind as a way of gaining wisdom the entire Eightfold Path. So all phenomena have mindfulness as their governing principle means that what we're holding in mind, mindfulness means to recollect or to hold in mind, what we're holding in mind is going to determine our experience with ordinary phenomena. And if what we're holding in mind is self-referential view, self-identification, then we're going to have a personal experience with impermanent and impersonal phenomena. If we're experiencing and interacting with ordinary phenomena, from a mind that is resting in equanimity and refined mindfulness, meaning seeing things from right view rather than wrong view, then that will be the governing principle of our experience of phenomena. Is that a little bit clear?
Mm-hmm. So it's right or wrong mindfulness.
Yeah. And there really is, you could really, there's a progression going from deluded to awakening. But ultimately, it really is that black and white. I'm either seeing things from right view or wrong view. Along the way, we recognize developing right view, and that's important. We talk about that often. But to see things in reality, not in a view ignorant of Four Noble Truths, means we're seeing things from right view. And how does the Buddha describe right view? Primarily, right view has a profound understanding of the nature of suffering. I would say a profound and penetrative understanding of the nature of suffering. And that view has been developed through the Eightfold Path, and it results in a mind that is resting in equanimity, resting in calm. And I mentioned it before, Helen, that's that aspect of compassion and the difference between simply acting out of compassion or acting out of an understanding of other suffering because we understand ourselves, changes that entire interaction, and it informs it in a way that's not entirely possible unless you've developed the Eightfold Path. We can talk more about that, but what you brought up on Tuesday, last Tuesday, got me thinking a little bit more about that. And it's why I say often, even Matt and I were on the radio yesterday, the most loving thing we can do is to take to the Dhamma. The most loving thing we can do for ourselves and all other sentient beings is to take to the Dhamma and awaken. And it's because of that. It's because then, as I'm interacting with someone in need, someone who is suffering, the phenomena of their suffering will be guided, the guiding principle of my experience of what's occurring will be guided by right view, be guided by mindfulness. All phenomena has mindfulness as their guiding principle. So the choice is ours. What are we going to hold in mind? It also points to something we brought up yesterday too. Not all mindfulness, just because you're mindful of something doesn't mean that you're engaging in something that is useful or helpful or skillful. Mindfulness means to hold in mind or to recollect. You can recollect or hold in mind anything. And I often use the example of when I was drinking and drugging, the only thought that I had was, where's my next drink coming from? That was mindfulness. And it's a classic definition of mindfulness. I was holding in mind, you know, my next bottle of pop-off.
Very focused.
It's actually really, it was all consuming in that type of mindfulness. And it's just a good example of mindfulness in and of itself is not necessarily skillful. And then even a compassionate or a positive type of holding in mind, this idea of positive thinking, I won't get into a long explanation, maybe one day I should. That's just, that type of, I always have to be thinking of positive things, is just as hurtful as anything else, because the underlying cause of that type of thinking is desire leading to fear, as it says in the Loka Sutta. So the Buddha taught a very refined type of mindfulness leading to seeing things clearly, leading to the cessation of ignorance. Right? So everybody's with me?
Everybody's with you.
Yes.
And I just, again, I wanted to establish that rather elaborate foundation. I know I did it last Tuesday too on the first part, to show you how much the sutta relates to this basic understanding of from ignorance comes suffering. There I am. And I'm just going to review something where we ended last week, and then I'm going to skip ahead a little bit. The Buddha's described these six properties that define a person. And they're ordinary, they're completely impersonal, they're simply part of the phenomena of living in a physical world, right? There's nothing within these six properties that are self-identifiable. In other words, each one of the properties is simply a property. It doesn't describe having an earth property as one of my properties doesn't make me me. In fact, it makes me not me. It makes me just mm-hmm. earth property, right? And I won't go through every property, but this is what the Buddha says in relation to each property. Earth, wind, fire, liquid, space, and consciousness. I'll touch on consciousness though. And what is the earth property? The earth property can be internal or external. The internal earth property is anything within oneself that is hard, solid, and sustained by craving, head, hair, body, nails, teeth, skin, flesh, tendons, bones, marrow, kidneys, heart, liver, memory, etc., etc. And he does that through each one of these properties relating to the fire property. It's all these elements that make up a body. Most of us look at only the four elements. That other element that is often unmentioned, the space property, is necessary because if it wasn't for the space property, there'd be no definition of us at all. And even he gets so basic as saying a space property is the mouth or the ear canals or the nose canal. I mean, we need to have the space property in order to function as human beings. Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Anything else internal within oneself that's hard, solid, and sustained by craving. Again, relates directly to dependent origination and the establishment of a self within ignorance. He's not describing a birth process or even establishment of a physical body, but our experience with what is ordinary and impersonal, but because of craving, it's now not. It's something we're taking personal. This is called the internal earth property. Very important line. Both internal earth property and external earth property are simply earth property. And he says that about each property. What the Buddha is referring to is that no matter, common during his time and just as common during our time in modern Buddhism, is a compulsive need to establish ourselves in non-physical reality. In fact, the most prevalent form of modern Buddhism does just exactly that. If you act a certain way and chant a certain way, when you die, you'll be taken to this special Buddhist heaven to be taken care of there. Very similar to other religions, isn't it? And again, I'm not putting down religions, it's just not something the Buddha taught. Or the idea of establishing myself in nothingness is the same type of idea. And that's the common theme in most Zen teachings, that there's no such thing as a self. This sutta clearly shows that the Buddha's not saying there's no such thing as a self. There is such a thing as a self, you just need to see it clearly. And any other establishment in an imaginary realm, such as, I don't know why I've been using this, I'm the world's greatest baker. Even if you are, even if you could take a consensus of 900 billion people and they all agree you're the best, it's still an imagination, in my imagination, that I'm establishing it, and it's a fabricated view. And it's obviously impermanent. Do you understand? That's an external. It's an establishment.
It just means non-physical.
Yes. Okay. And as the Buddha teaches here,
it doesn't mean outside the body.
There's nothing special about it. It's the establishment of an internal or external earth property is happening because of fabrications. Hmm. There's nothing there. It's not a non-physical establishment that simply doesn't relate to the Dhamma. It's just a distraction. It's a fabricated view. And later on in the sutta, the Buddha will mention it even more directly as saying that any type of speculative or supposition, I guess use the word suppositional view, is a fabrication. Let go of it. Which is really his description of anatta, isn't it? The Buddha teaches anatta not as that there's no such thing as a self. It says the Buddha's, what anatta means in the Buddha's Dhamma is that your views you're holding of a self don't constitute a self. They're wrong views. Let go of the views. They're fabricated views. Okay. I just wanted to explain that, though. This is that idea of internal and external establishments is, again, lies at the core of the Buddha's teaching, because the Dhamma ultimately takes us to a place where we have finally reunited the mind and the body, and we keep it there. There's nothing to distract us out of our body or out. And another way of saying that is being mindful of what's occurring in this moment. Okay, I'm going to skip over quite a bit here. Excuse me for a minute. Oh, I missed the missed an important part of that. The Buddha says, this is how, and this relates to all of the different properties, this is how the earth property should be seen by one with right discernment, right view. This is not me, this is not mine, this is not what I am, this is not myself. When one sees this as it has come to be, with right discernment, or right view, or right understanding, one becomes disenchanted with the earth property. And through lack of sustenance, meaning lack of clinging and maintaining, the earth property fades from the mind. It's all we need to do. Stop being disenchanted with eye-making. Stop insisting that what is a fabricated view of me is, because it's not. It's just a fabrication. And he repeats that to all the other properties. This is not me, this is not mine, this is not myself. And I've talked about that when you find yourself reacting just in your mundane world, to just remind yourself, take a breath and remind, this is not me, this is not mine, this is not myself. I don't have to own this. It's exactly what he taught Bahia, and he teaches Pukkasati here too, in all of us. Same thing happens too. Maybe we shouldn't say that, huh? And what is the consciousness property? This is a slight deviance here. Consciousness free of fabrication remains pure and bright. So in this sequence, the Buddha is reminding Pukkasati that don't get too depressed from all this, because there's a way of developing a consciousness that remains pure and bright. What is perceived by consciousness? One perceives pleasure, one perceives pain, one perceives neither pleasure nor pain. In dependence on sensory contact, that is to be felt as pleasure, there arises a feeling of pleasure. That's such an important line. That speaks to intention, specifically wrong intention. If I'm grasping after pleasure, that means I'm setting myself up to feel pleasure. I'm opening myself up to the world to something that is demanding is to be felt as pleasure. What is to be felt as pleasure? There arises a feeling of pleasure. It's up to me. It's not a lucky occurrence that something happens to me. It's because of what I'm holding in mind and my views of the world. Due to self-identification, one perceives I am sensing a feeling of pleasure. In dependence on sensory contact that is to be felt as pain, there arises a feeling of pain. Due to self-identification, one perceives I am sensing a feeling of pain. In dependence on sensory contact that is to be felt as neither pleasure nor pain, there arises a feeling of neither pleasure nor pain. Again, like almost like a self-fulfilling prophecy. What our intention is in going into something is going to determine what we're holding in mind is the governing principle. It's going to be felt as one of these things. Due to self-identification, one perceives I am sensing neither pleasure nor pain, the feeling of ambiguity or boredom. Through refined mindfulness, one understands that with the cessation of self-identification of that very sensory contact, the feeling of pleasure has arisen independently of that contact. So the experience is exactly the same, isn't it? But there's no self-identification. There's no fabrication. I'm simply experiencing what's occurring as it's occurring without any need for it to be any different than it is. What does that also describe? A stress-free, suffering-free, disappointment-free life. What is to be felt as pleasure is simply pleasure. Simply a pleasurable experience.
And with the word independent that he uses there, he basically says that the chain of dependent origination is broken here.
Right there. That's a great observation. It's independent of any fabrication. And he's describing something that is incredibly mundane, isn't it? To someone who didn't really understand the Dhamma, it would seem almost unimportant until we understand that it is in these mundane moments of life that the Dhamma is most important, because it's the mundane moments of life that we are bored with, we're ambiguous about. We want to get to something that's more exciting, the view is so skewed that even something that is mundane and truly impersonal is taken personal.
And it creates... All these small moments make up the all of our suffering.
Each and every moment. And so again, getting back to the underlying theme, and you just mentioned, each moment holds the potential to either become awakened or become further ignorant.
I mean, the energy taken up to generate these fabrications is immense.
It's immense, and it's ultimately debilitating. And medical science is proving that now, isn't it?
Well,
it's something that the Buddha understood 2,600 years ago. The medical profession is finding that stress is the underlying cause of probably most diseases, if you really get to it. And forget about the idea of physical or mental disease. Think about your ongoing moment-by-moment life, to be free of all of that stress. That's what the Buddha's whole Dhamma is about. And a stress arises because of a misunderstanding of who I am and what I am.
Well, in that way, what does stress have to stick to in order for it to be experienced as pain? It has to stick to me. It has to stick to an identification. It has to stick to anatta. It has to stick to something that is referring to itself as experiencing pain.
Yeah, beautiful. And that view is a fabricated view. It's not like if it's not a fabricated view, so like there's a little bit something wrong there, it's all wrong. It's all wrong view. And that can be hard to take to when you first realize the gravity of what I just said, because it's almost like saying I'm a complete useless mushroom. I don't know why I said mushroom, but I didn't want to say something else. But understanding that I'm a complete useless mushroom leads to how incredible it is to know. It truly leads to, and it's not a miracle that it happens, but a miraculous way of being in the world, because you're in the world without needing the world or yourself to be any different than it is. We had a couple of interesting talks leading to this idea of an underlying wrong views of self as ongoing self-loathing. We're never enough for ourselves or the world around us. We're always grasping and at some ways to establish ourselves. Some people think that it's power. Some people think that it's a show of money or, you know, that type of thing, position, et cetera, et cetera. We're always struggling to be better than we are. When the Buddha says there's nothing to be better than, you simply are. And that's enough. In fact, it's everything. I better get back to this stuff. The Buddha continues, through refined mindfulness, one understands that with the cessation of self-identification of that very sensory contact, the feeling of pleasure that has arisen independently of that contact. What is to be felt as pleasure ceases, it is stilled. In other words, the grasping after wanting more, wanting the third and the fourth and the fifth piece of chocolate cake, is gone, it's stilled, because I'm present with what's there. And because the grasping has stilled, my mind has stilled, relating directly back to dependent origination. And how do I cease grasping? By developing wisdom, by understanding the nature of suffering is rooted in my grasping, in my craving, in my clinging and maintaining. And understanding that I've done that, or I'm still doing it, excuse me, because I misunderstand what I am, what I'm made of. Better continue, it's going to get too late. And that relates again, we've gone to the idea of restraint at the sixth sense base. It's at that point of contact that we begin to integrate the Dhamma moment by moment. When our minds are agitated in some way, this is not me, this is not mine, this is not myself. And in every instance when that occurs, you can recognize the impermanence of what has your attention and what you're reacting to, because it always is. It's all phenomena. All phenomena has mindfulness as its governing principle. What are you holding in mind in this moment? Through refined mindfulness, one understands that with the cessation of self-identification of that very sensory contact, the feeling of pain has arisen independently of that contact. What is to be felt as pain ceases and it is stilled. The same thing with neither pleasure nor pain. I'll skip over that. Just as when two sticks are brought together and agitated, heat and fire are born dependent on contact and agitation. In other words, you can have two sticks in your hand and wave them around all you want, you're not going to get fire. But you start rubbing them together, and if you know a little bit about what you're trying to do, you might make fire. I said that because there's a few times I couldn't. I thought I could. Anyway, those are cold nights up on top of Barefoot Ridge. When the sticks are separated and the agitation ceases, heat subsides and the fire is extinguished. When you stop reacting to contact at the sixth sense base, there's nothing to give rise to passion. There's the fires of passion. In the same manner, an agitated mind, lacking concentration, independence on contact, will feel feelings of pleasure, feelings of pain, or feelings of neither pleasure nor pain. That's the only three feelings we can have. A wise Dhamma practitioner understands that with the cessation of self-referential sensory contact, feelings of pleasure or pain or neither pleasure nor pain are stilled. With a cessation of self-reference. That's all it takes. And all that takes is understanding who and what we are, and we free ourselves of that self-identification. Now there remains, once that process is concluded, now there remains only a mind established in equanimity, luminous, pure, supple, and spacious. Just as if a supple goldsmith were to take raw gold and through skillful effort transform that raw gold into a refined and flawless ornament, malleable and luminous, the gold would now suit the goldsmith's purpose. I think Lorna brought up, you were a little confusing. What the Buddha is describing there is simply when we gain the ability to think what we want to think when we want to think it, our life is just that, in the Vitakasanthana Sutta. We can experience our life in a pure and luminous form through our own understanding. We're the goldsmith in this metaphor.
And it doesn't give rise at that point to pleasure, pain, or ambiguity.
No, because you're not now engaged in the world in a search for fulfillment, because you know it can't be found there. You're simply engaged in the world because why?
<It's there. laughs>
Because you're there. And think about that though. That's enough. We don't need any other justification for being in the world, except we're in the world. That's it. Do you see that? But this self-referential ego personality is always trying to justify its existence. What are you good for? What have you done for me lately? I mean, where do those sayings come from? What have I done for myself lately? Well, the most important thing, the most loving thing I can do for myself and all other sentient beings is to awaken. And then I can put aside all that other stuff that is just distraction and prone to confusion, deluded thinking, and ongoing disappointing experiences. I want to work something in tonight if I can. I hope so. It has to do with you, Kevin, by the way. In the same manner, one whose mind is established in equanimity, luminous, pure, supple, and spacious, knows that if I were to direct my thinking towards non-physical dimensions of infinite consciousness, or infinite space, or infinite emptiness, or nothingness, or the dimension of neither perception nor non-perception, etc., 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 any non-physical establishment of non-becoming, I would know these distracted mind states as fabricated. Any self-referential establishment, the Buddha is referring to these more mystical adaptations of self-reference or non-becoming, simply because they were common during his time and just as common today. But any time we try to establish, I think I used this, the mushroom thing again last week, that someone tells me that eating mushrooms is really healthy, by the way, it probably is. So I'm going to eat as many mushrooms as I can, and I'm going to be the healthiest person in the world. In fact, I remember years and years ago, I read this study about they were feeding, I remember, they were keeping, it sounds a little disgusting, but they were keeping chicken meat, like a chicken breast, fresh and lively by injecting it with very, very high levels of nutrients. And the supposition was, the speculation that they came to, was that a highly nutritious but very, very low-calorie diet should allow people to live 160 or 180 years. There's still people that believe that, and I think it happens to be true, by the way. I think it's probably the best diet, is a highly nutritious but low in calorie diet. But I took to that with fervor that I'm going to live to 100 years old. I mean, to 200 years old. That was my goal. Mm-hmm. I hope I can explain this well. I was establishing myself not here right now eating good food with very low calories. My mind was always what I'm going to be like at 200. Mm. I'm going to be the healthiest 200-year-old person the world has ever seen. And I've just missed 150 years of my life.
Because you've been so busy trying to feed yourself this particular diet.
To be something other than what I am. That's becoming anything other than self, when the Buddha teaches that. And it's also an aspect of non-becoming, isn't it? Because it's not something that's happening now. So there's nothing wrong with eating highly nutritious, low-calorie food as long as I don't use it as a distraction and for further self-establishment. I do it simply because it's what I'm doing. Is that clear? Because it's such an important point in the whole notion of this establishing yourself in non-physical realms. See those as fabricated. A wise Dhamma practitioner does not fabricate or mentally construct for the sake of self-establishment. A wise Dhamma practitioner does not fabricate or mentally construct for the sake of self-establishment, and I'll continue that, in this physical realm or any fabricated or imaginary non-physical realm. And so again, we're not talking about some grand mystical realm. Anytime I'm creating an imaginary view of myself in my own mind, it's a fabricated view that's prone to ongoing confusion, deluded thinking, and ongoing suffering. And if I take that fabricated view, hold it as myself, and then bring it into the world, and the world doesn't agree with my view of who I am, look at the trouble I've made for myself, and really probably for everyone else that I'm going to argue the point with about who I am and what I am and what I've established, rather than being a peaceful sage who knows what he is. I don't have to bring anything to the world. I've gone beyond the world. That's what the Buddha means by that. There's no me here, like you said to Bahia, there's no me here, there, or anywhere else. I'm simply at peace. I'm a sage at peace. This one is not just... let me go back a little bit. Any physical realm or any fabricated or imaginary non-physical realm. Fabrication's abandoned. This one is not sustained through craving. The Buddha doesn't have to say, and this person is now sustained by, because there's nothing necessary to sustain these six properties. They just are. This one is released from clinging to anything in the world. Release from wrong... I'll skip over that. This one is no longer agitated. Their mind is calm and well concentrated. Buddha's description of an awakened mind. This one knows their mind is calm and well concentrated. It's important. How do we know we're developing the path correctly? Because we know. We experience deepening levels of concentration. We find ourselves framing our mundane moment-by-moment life from the Eightfold Path. One of the interviewers yesterday asked a great question. This was after we talked about what we're doing here and the people that come and what we teach. And she asked a question, is there anybody there that has actually felt the benefit of it? And she was relating to the work life. But it's a reasonable question, especially someone who has seen a lot of different, done a lot of different things and not really found a real benefit. And I gave examples of quite a few of you without using your name. But the truth is that each and every one of you, I think you would agree, and please say no if you don't, it's okay. I would bet that each and every one of you has had a practical experience of integrating the Dhamma into your life, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. And then her focus was on, I got a little bit of time. Her focus was, most of her questions were related to using this to improve your work performance, which is reasonable. You know, it's a big part of our lives. But it dawned on me as I was sitting there that to only think that that's the only useful application is really missing a point. The Dhamma is to be experienced in every moment of our lives. And I happen to think of one of our Sangha members who's a pretty good golfer. Excuse me for outing you.
You're a good golfer.
It's just a view of it. I'm not that good.
Well,
it's a lot of work to hold that view.
So, I'm just so disappointed.
Just look at my scorecard.
As we were going around, you know, it helps you in your job performance. I thought of Kevin Palmer here. How his experience with golf went from quite stressful to now just the act of golfing, playing golf, is its own reward, correct?
Exactly. Right.
That is remarkable. And the point, the reason why I said it yesterday and the reason why I'm bringing it up now, it's just as significant to experience the Dhamma in something as seemingly frivolous as golf as it is as improving your work performance or being more pleasant at work. You could say that they're both significant and they're both frivolous. One isn't more important than the other. The Dhamma, and the point of that, is when we understand these six properties, there's nothing personal about this, then there's nothing personal about any aspect of our lives. And each and every moment, you've heard me say this before, is meaningful because it's what's occurring. It needs no other qualification. It doesn't need another qualification after, just like after becoming. It's what is occurring, and I'm present for it. I'm present for that 4-foot putt that just falls in, and I'm also present for that 4-foot putt that just misses. And I'm present. She was an accountant. I'm present for when I might make a mistake with someone's numbers, but I'm not taking it personally because I know I'm doing the best I can. And I'm present when a client says you did just a great job. And none of it matters. None of it matters because it all matters. It doesn't. None of it matters, but it's all significant. Because for the first time, I'm able to be present with what's occurring, Kevin.
Yeah, exactly. And that whole thing, I mean, it's letting go of the view that is where the release came from, that nothing's really different, except prior to engaging with the Dhamma or practicing the Dhamma, it would be having to maintain this view of
playing this game for 20 years, having played in college, having associations through this game, having trophies through this game, whatever it is, and if it's not to what that view is, it's stressful because it's not fitting in. It's not going that way. It may be no fun for a while, and then, you know, as the views are let go of, you know, whereas it used to be work and this, you know, it's a thing you do a lot for a long time most of the time. It used to be stressful. I have all this work to do to get to be better or to be this view, and it's nothing like that anymore. I mean, I'm learning from a new teacher, and I'm having fun learning because, like we just said, it's being there and enjoying the experience regardless of it. It's a moment to be cherished.
Yeah.
Whether it's frustration, I can't figure this out, or I figured it out, it's letting go of those views has made it a whole lot more fun and enjoyable.
And you don't need those fabricated views, those self-referential views, to motivate you.
No, whether I win a trophy or not.
Yeah.
But actually, it would help me, I think.
Well, the reason why I asked the question,
better. It would be I'd be more calm.
Yeah.
That's simply what it would look like, I think.
A view that continues, that is rooted in ignorance and continues eye making is, well, what's gonna motivate me to live? Why would I go out in the world if I didn't have any of this self-reference? Well, you can't know that until you get there, but you just described it. And also you can look at other people that have awakened, such as the Buddha. He wanted to. You know, remember the story of his awakening. He thought, this is just too difficult. I'm going to just sit here and meditate the rest of my life, until he realized how important this was. And he spent 45 years of the most successful and involved life without being entangled in the world. Now, hopefully we can finish this. This one knows their mind is calm and well concentrated. This one knows birth is now ended, right? It's not physical birth, although we can talk about it. I'll wait till we get to the truth of happiness, but karma and rebirth has been coming up a lot lately. It's birth, giving birth to another moment rooted in ignorance. Birth is now ended. A life well integrated to the Eightfold Path has been lived. My task is now complete. There is nothing further for this world. In other words, there's nothing further for self-establishment in this world. Skip over. Friend Pukkasati. When sensing a feeling, everybody remembers this setting. The Buddha came into this hut. Pukkasati doesn't really know. Okay. Friend Pukkasati, when sensing a feeling of pleasure, understand it as impersonal, and as such, it's impermanent. It relates directly to the Anattalakkhana Sutta, doesn't it? If it's impermanent, how could it be me? Understanding thus, craving and clinging vanish. Understanding that everything, all phenomena is impersonal and it's impermanent, understanding thus, craving and clinging vanish. Likewise, when sensing a feeling of pain, or sensing a feeling of pleasure, or sensing a feeling of neither pleasure nor pain, understand these feelings as impersonal and as such impermanent. Because they are. They're not rooted in anything that defines me, unless I decide that it does. Understanding thus, craving and clinging vanish. Understanding brings the awareness that pleasure, pain, and neither pleasure nor pain are impersonal and as such impermanent, and are not craved after or self-identified with. Relating again directly back to dependent origination, doesn't it? And why we should interrupt those chain of dependencies. And where we can interrupt those chain of dependencies at any point, but now the Buddha is specifically pointing to self-identification and name and form, and contact, et cetera, et cetera. Not craved after or self-identified with. When feeling pleasure, pain, or neither pleasure nor pain, a wise Dhamma practitioner remains disjoined through lack of self-identification from these feelings. The Buddha often describes the nature of suffering and through fabrication and wrong views of self is that we have joined with our suffering, and don't we do that? Don't we identify ourselves as those things that are causing pain or even pleasure? And it might just be, I had a good day. Or give a list of all these good things that happened to me today. Or I had an awful day. You know, that person bumped into me at the shopping center. They're all joining with our pain. Here the Buddha is saying through this, a wise Dhamma practitioner remains disjoined from those feelings. We're still in the world. We're still experiencing what's occurring, but there's no self-identification. I'm disjoined from it, no longer clinging. This one understands feelings in the body are limited to the body. A powerful line. Does everybody understand that? Feelings in the body are limited to the body?
Can't go anywhere else.
It's very hard, is that one for me.
I'm glad you were honest.
It's very hard. And particularly
limited to the
pain.
Body. Now, how did the Buddha describe the body? These six properties. The four elements, the space property,
the
and the consciousness property.
The earth property.
The feeling is limited to that. It's not a part of anything else. It's only becomes, I only join with it through a fabricated view.
Mm-hmm.
It's limited to the body. It's not
why is this happening to me?
Yes.
Right.
That was limited to the body, even though it probably looked pretty foolish to you. Why is that idiot slapping himself? It's limited to the body. It's not happening to me, like you just said, Helen. And it's just as important, this next line.
I think of it now as the earth, my body's the earth property, it's part of the earth. It's not.
Yeah.
It's, and it'll corrode and everything else, like, you know, impermanence and everything else.
Yep.
And
so
I'm trying to, like, think of my body as the, it's just another aspect of the earth property, this body.
Yeah, and the other properties too. And they're all completely impersonal. You know, you're made up of these six properties, so am I, so is everybody else. So how can I take it personal? How could I think anything of myself in one way or another? Meaning, how could I think of myself as better or less than? When we are at the most basic and significant level, the same. It's the same elements. It doesn't mean that we're all going to watch out this unity consciousness thing. We're made up of something that has no inherent self in it. It's just these elements. And what is felt in this body is limited here. In other words, I don't have to take it and bring it into some non-physical, worrisome plane of, well, I got hurt yesterday, I hope I don't get hurt tomorrow. You understand why I'm taking that?
Mm-hmm.
Or, she smiled at me at the coffee counter. I hope she does tomorrow. I'm using something silly, but we get caught up in those kind of things, don't we?
Right.
That's what, it's limited to the body. The pleasurable feeling when somebody smiled at me is limited to this body. It's not personal.
Right.
I just threw flirting all into Helen.
What's on your mind?
That cup of coffee I got. Nothing.
I'll be right back. I need a cup of coffee.
I need a cold shower. Nothing is personal. But it's when we take something personal that we get excited in this case. We get distracted. We get thrown into the future. And things that we're carrying with us from the past now come into my
mm-hmm.
consciousness. I'm distracted. I'm confused. I'm deluded. I'm anything other than self. And I'm likely to continue to become anything other than self. Because I'm stuck in a fabricated view until I realize, wait a minute, what I'm feeling is just limited to this body. There's nothing. And now this next line. This one understands feelings limited to human life are limited to human life. It points to that whole notion of speculation and supposition about what's going to happen to me later on. No matter what's occurring to me, you know, we all say you can't take it with you. But the Buddha's saying that in such an incredibly profound way. No matter what occurs in this life, it's just limited to this human life. So then, what's the most important thing in this human life?
It's to be here, present.
To awaken. It's not getting all the toys. It's not anything. The most important thing is to awaken. It doesn't mean that we should stop interacting or taking care of our families or being loving to people around us. But underlying all that should be, and that's what the whole Buddha's Dhamma speaks to, should be the motivation to awaken. Because getting back to what Helen brought up on Tuesday night, it is the most loving thing I can do for myself and all other sentient beings. If I really do and I think most human beings do, we just are rooted in ignorance. If I really do care about the world and the people in this world and what's going on in the world, the most significant thing I can do is to recognize ignorance and develop wisdom. Because now there's another wise person in the world, not contributing to suffering.
And recognizing the ignorance is, that's the key.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you just keep going, wanting to do well, and you're not.
And you wonder why you can't. You know, I know.
Frustration.
Yeah, we all have. I know when I think we're all, unless there's something organically wrong, we're all brought into this world caring about other human beings. And yet sometimes we fall so far short. And I know there were things that I did, especially when I was younger and really, you know, crazy with drugs and alcohol, that were hurtful, unintentionally, but hurtful towards people. And it wasn't who I was, and I couldn't even understand why I was doing these kind of things. Because I didn't mean it, you know, or even just striking out at people in anger, saying things that you wish you didn't say. We've all done it, right? Maybe Matt has it. And we always feel awful
just
about it.
My wife.
Yeah. We feel awful when we do those things, don't we? You know, some of us try to justify it and blame it, but we always feel awful when we do something, when we hurt other people. We just do. But we don't know why we do it, do we? We can't understand it. And the reason why we can't understand it is because our minds are rooted in ignorance. We don't understand where that conditioned reflex comes from with, go do yourself.
The whole metaphor of the links in this chain, why is there any point in a chain that can be broken other than ignorance?
Ultimately, that is. But
and that's why sometimes people say, well, I can stop it at contact. But if there's ignorance, then it's some form of a self-help program.
Yeah, you bring up such a good point though, David. There, if we're engaging in restraint at point of contact, from the framework of the Eightfold Path, then we can unravel the chain. We can break the links.
Because at that point we see the.
Yes, and that's what. In fact, it is at any of these links in the chain. Pardon me.
But it's not. You're not. Awakened person. That's why.
Yes.
Like during our retreat, the concept of restraint to me seemed to be, while you're getting there, show restraint at this point, but truly becoming wise, replacing ignorance, is really the only way you can become awakened.
Yes, and it is directly in that process. So practicing restraint at the sixth sense base is necessary and an integral part of the Eightfold Path to know where to do it, right speech, right action, right light, etc. Because it helps to recognize and diminish ignorance. Once I get to that point where I've let go of all fabricated views, there's no need for restraint. In fact, it wouldn't be a concern because I simply wouldn't be acting in a way that requires restraint. But all phenomena has mindfulness as their governing principle. So the phenomena, this is the really the brilliance of the Buddha and the Eightfold Path. He tried to figure out what can I bring into a mind rooted in ignorance to get it to recognize its own ignorance. And think about that. If you didn't have something, how do you know that you're deluded? How do you know you're ignorant of something unless there's something to recognize it? That's what the Eightfold Path does. And so the refined mindfulness becomes our governing principle within phenomena and allows us to see the result of ignorance. It allows us to see fabricated views. And in very specific ways, the Buddha is saying here, if you find you're establishing yourself in non-physical, speculative, or suppositional realms, know it is fabrication. Don't make a religion at it. Don't make a lifetime practice at it. It's fabricated, including, you know, the mystical connotations with the practical connotations. I'm the world's greatest baker or the world's greatest meditation teacher, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
I am this.
Yeah. But you got to watch that because that gets into Vedanta, which isn't, they come out of a different way.
Well, just was in the sutta. You know, he lists all of the speculations.
Yeah, let me get to it. Let me finish this. This one understands feelings limited to human life are limited to human life. This one understands that with the ending of life and the breakup of the body, that all that is experienced and not joined to will grow cold and end right then. All the speculation about the future. Again, it's a reminder that if we're awakened, we understand that we've lived the highest well-integrated life we possibly can. But no matter what, we're all going to end up that same way. Just as an oil lamp burns in dependence on wick and oil, from the termination of wick and oil, it would be unnourished and cease. In the same manner, when a wise Dharma practitioner is feeling a feeling limited to the body, they understand, I am sensing a feeling that is limited to this body. In other words, I'm not taking it personal. There's no self-identification. When a wise Dharma practitioner is feeling a feeling limited to human life, they understand, I am sensing a feeling limited to human life. And again, I want to try to get to this quicker, but it also relates back to what Helen brought up last week. It was a very profound question, Helen. Understanding the suffering in the world is, and from the point of view of the Dhamma, is understanding that suffering is inherent in having a human life. Birth, sickness, aging, death, not getting what you want, getting what you don't want. That's the suffering of all people, isn't it? And that's the first arrow. Now, of course, we've developed as a society ways that are hurtful towards others, but at the very core of suffering lies having a human life and being rooted in ignorance. So again, if I really care about other people, and we all do, what's the most important thing? To at least be an example of someone who has freed themselves of ignorance. Thank you for bringing that up Tuesday, by the way. Led to a lot of thinking and I think some good Dhamma. The wise Dhamma practitioner understands that the ending of life and the breakup of the body, that all life is experienced and not joined to, will grow cold and end right then and there. In this manner, when one has the highest determination for understanding, for the knowledge of the arising and passing away of suffering and stress, this one has achieved the greatest noble understanding. This Dhamma practitioner has gained release from all views ignorant of Four Noble Truths. Their mind has established right view, now resting in pure truth. This view will no longer fluctuate due to distraction. This one knows whatever is deceptive and remains free from associating with deception. Another way of saying a well-focused Dhamma practice. This Dhamma practitioner is established with the highest determination for truth. This is the foremost unbinding from wrong views and is the highest noble truth. Now, when I read this, I was thinking, is the Buddha referring to himself here? And he very well may be, or he may just be describing someone who hasn't developed quite this understanding. Formerly, when still ignorant of Four Noble Truths, this Dhamma practitioner foolishly craved after mental acquisitions and created self-identities clinging to these mental acquisitions. This Dhamma practitioner has completely abandoned them. Through the Eightfold Path, this one has cut fabrications off at the root of ignorance. Like the stump of a palmyra tree, now deprived of the conditions of sustenance, fabrications will no longer arise. How do we end fabrications? We cut ignorance off at its root. How do we do it? Through an Eightfold Path. Likewise, when still ignorant of Four Noble Truths, this Dhamma practitioner foolishly was driven by desire and self-infatuation, by ill will and hatred, by delusion and ignorance, and created self-identities clinging to these unskillful qualities. Now this Dhamma practitioner has completely abandoned them. Through the Eightfold Path, this one has cut fabrications off at the root of ignorance. Again, like the stump of a palmyra tree, now deprived of the conditions of sustenance, fabrications will no longer arise. This Dhamma practitioner has established the highest determination for calm, for the calming of greed, aversion, and deluded thinking. This one has established the highest noble calm. This Dhamma practitioner knows to never neglect right view, to always guard the truth, and to always train for establishing a calm and well-centered, well-concentrated mind. That's why the Buddha taught a singular meditation practice. This Dhamma practitioner understands that where, through wise restraint, the currents of speculation and supposition do not flow. There's that saying that we wander around samsara, and it's often the metaphor of being stuck in this river. here the Buddha's using it again. When we're stuck in speculation and supposition, we're caught in that flow, aren't we?
Mm-hmm.
And it's nearly impossible to get out of that speculative and suppositional way of looking at ourselves in relation to the world. There's the Eightfold Path. This Dharma practitioner understands where, through wise restraint, the currents of speculation and supposition do not flow. This one is known as a sage at peace. With reference to what I am saying to you, all of the following is speculation and supposition. Matt just mentioned this. All of the following is speculation and supposition. I am this, I will be, I will not be. I will have this form, I will not have this form. I will have psychic powers, I will not have psychic powers. That's such an important line because there's many, many traditions, including the traditions during the Buddha's time, that an awakened human being will be able to display psychic powers. That's how they know and you know if they're really authentic. The Buddha completely discounted this here and many other suttas, that those are really just magician's tricks. And some of us know that directly. Some of us can take my word and take the Buddha's word on it. But the use and display of psychic powers does in no way describe any type of understanding in relation to what the Buddha's teaching. And that's what he means about establishing yourself in these non-physical realms. It's all part of that. The Buddha continues, speculation and supposition are diseases, a cancer, an arrow. By abandoning all speculation and supposition, including the speculation on the world's greatest baker, and supposition, this Dharma practitioner is known as a sage of peace, simply letting go of all those wrong views rooted in speculation, rooted in fabrication. A sage at peace is no longer distracted or agitated by birth, aging, sickness, death, sorrow, regret, greed, aversion, or deluded thinking. With no distraction or agitation, what would this practitioner crave for or cling to? This Dharma practitioner understands where the currents of speculation and supposition do not flow. When through wise restraint the currents of speculation and supposition do not flow, this one is known as a sage at peace. Now, friend Pukkasati, you should remember my brief analysis of the six properties. Was it brief?
Not really.
Then the thought occurred to Venerable Pukkasati. We're almost done. Surely the great teacher has come to me. Surely the rightly self-awakened one has come to me. Pukkasati rose and bowed to the Buddha and said, I was foolish, confused, and unskillful to address you merely as friend, meaning he did not to recognize the Buddha as a Buddha. Please accept my apology so that I may restrain myself in the future. The Buddha replied, yes, confusion overcame you, but most importantly, you have recognized your confusion and in accordance with my Dhamma, have made the strong determination to end your confusion. That relates to all of us. It doesn't matter how confused we may have been. It doesn't matter where we came from, what we did, anything. It's recognizing that I'm confused, my mind has been rooted in ignorance, and now the Buddha said, it is just this determination and discipline that one grows in the Dhamma and practices restraint in the future. Great teacher, please accept me into the order to follow your Dhamma. The Buddha asked, do you have an alms bowl and robes? No, replied Pukkasati. Then gather a bowl and robes, and I will give you the going forth, meaning he will ordain him. Pukkasati was delighted. He bowed to the Buddha and left in search of an alms bowl and robes for his ordination. While searching, a runaway cow trampled and killed Pukkasati. A large group from the Sangha found the Buddha and told him of Pukkasati's demise. They asked the Buddha what Pukkasati's future state would be. Avoiding speculation, the Buddha said, friends, Pukkasati was wise. He practiced the Dhamma in accordance with my instruction, and he never pestered me with unrelated issues. He has abandoned the five fetters of self-identification, grasping at rituals and practices, doubt and uncertainty, sensual craving, and deluded thinking. He is now free of fabricated views and will never again be subject to the suffering born of ignorance. He is now free of the fabricated views and will never again be subject to the suffering born of ignorance. That's the Buddha's description of what happened to Pukkasati. Those that heard these words of the Buddha were delighted. That's the end of the sutta. Thank you. Simple and direct, but there's a lot there, isn't there? And it points to how ordinary we are. But it also points to how remarkable we are to have a Dhamma still prevalent today and something that we can all use. We're just like those folks that the Buddha was describing 2,600 years ago, made up of these six properties. And we can still use our minds united with our bodies to awaken. Remarkable.
Yeah, we should watch out for cows.
And we should, well, keep that in mind. You know, the cow's going to get us. We never know when. So, it's gotten a little late, but let's go around the room kind of quickly. Matt, good to see you.
Good to see you, John. Good to see everybody. Thank you for this teaching.
My pleasure. It really was my pleasure. I'm looking forward to this. Thank you, Matt. Florida.
Is that it? Well, during Matt's Qigong on Saturday, I had one or two like thoughts, one after the other, one led into the other, into the other. And it started off with me saying, in a very foolish way, that, you know, in a joking way, that this is my chi, you know. Go away, don't pinch my chi. I was just sort of joking in the group sort of thing. And I knew how silly that was, because chi is everywhere. It doesn't belong to anybody. It's everywhere. It just occurred to me that I can't own anything. Like, I can't own my chi, I can't own anything in the world. And when you think about impermanence, why would you want to?
Yeah.
Why would you want to try and hold on to a physical object or something like that when you know it's going to deteriorate and decay? And why would you want to? And I've never looked at anything in the world like, why would I want to hold on to it? I've never got there in my thinking. So I thought that was quite a step.
Actually.
It is. Yeah. And then from this humongous sutta, I wish I could hold everything that you've just said over the last 2 weeks in mind, but you just can't. It's rather profound when he says that when you pass away and your body grows cold, all your fabrications stop at that time. They just stop, which is perfectly true.
Yeah.
And they stop because they never really are of any substance in the world. You can see them like that. They're just thoughts that we carry around in our mind.
Yeah.
And once you pass, your mind stops. And all that we have right at that moment, just like, it's gone.
Yeah.
No more self-reverence.
Yeah.
One way or another.
Yeah.
Well, and that's another way of saying that all phenomena has mindfulness as its governing principle.
Mm-hmm.
Fabrications manifest in the world because of my, that's what I'm holding in mind.
Mm-hmm.
That's the governing principle. And you really describe applying this. You're taking things in a completely impersonal way. Why? Because everything that makes up a person is just these six impersonal properties. And that's a way to incorporate this too. Just you can remind yourself too that this is just what I am. And remember the 18 considerations and the four determinations. The consideration of when the 18 considerations has to do with each element, and that we can perceive something as either pleasure or pain or through equanimity by not self-identifying with it. And the four determinations are simply the determinations ultimately to awaken, to develop the truth, develop calm. That's what it's all about. Thank you. Kevin, good to see you.
It's great to see you. Nice to be here. Really like this teaching. It just, as you've been saying, there's so much in there. But I really like how at the end he was saying the wise Dhamma practitioner recognizes this inside or outside the body, and you can just, it just provides context for the additional weight that our thoughts can have on worldly phenomena occurring in our daily lives and as we go about them. So I really, really appreciated that.
Yeah.
It's very clarifying.
I cut you off with my back.
No, that's it.
Thank you. Ron, good to see you.
Good to be here again. As far far as holding on to the body, the only reason to hold on to the body is this is your vehicle for awakening. But it's not really holding on, it's like treat it well. And
that's right.
Get your, keep your opportunity for awakening alive.
Yeah, and that avoids that asceticism from an extreme view.
Mm-hmm.
If it's the most important thing to me is to awaken, it's probably going to, hopefully, the cow's going to give me a little bit of time, so let me take care of myself as best I can to do that. And the other things, you know, preparing, or just organizing your life for practice, putting some time aside for meditation and listening to Dhamma talks and reading the Dhamma and coming to class, that's all part of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I also hope to have a bit more time in the future, because I'm realizing that, because I really put some, I tried to put some time into studying this, and I'm realizing I have to work on my study,
mm-hmm.
how I study the suttas, especially with the teacher training coming up at some point.
Yeah, it's going to start, I'll get the word out hopefully this
mm-hmm.
week.
And maybe that can even be part of the training itself to learn how to study these.
Absolutely.
Oh, that is going that is part of the teaching training. There's no substitution for what we do here, and I've organized the whole Sangha experience in that way. I send out an email hoping that people, and I think you all do, read too. It's not just coming here and listening to me, and not just coming here and meditating, it's reading. I've had so many realizations by reading the suttas that it was because of that. And while developing a right meditation practice and developing some concentration, but it can't, you have to actually do the study too.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have to be arduous. It doesn't have to be 24/7. But
In a complicated, this is a fairly complicated sutta.
It is,
at least in my view. I realize I have to have a better method for study.
Yeah.
Just reading through it and highlighting it that's only part of it. I have trouble grasping the overall stuff.
Yeah, the way to do that though, and it's always a good idea to maybe review the Paticca-samuppada Sutta, dependent origination, and the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the Magga-Vibhanga Sutta, the analysis of the Eightfold Path, to the point of boredom, because that's what frames everything, that's a little hard to do if we're looking for distraction or entertainment, but to the point of boredom, and as you understand the context, then you can understand how these individual suttas apply.
Because it's almost through that boredom that you start to actually integrate it.
Yeah.
It becomes part of it.
Yeah, there's nothing, there's no other way to develop the Dhamma except to develop the Dhamma.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Mary, good to see you.
Good to see you. Good to see everyone. Thank you for this teaching. I think I'll just leave it at that. Thank you.
Thank you. David, good to see you tonight. How are you?
Good, John. Thank you for your talk tonight. To go to what Ram was talking about, I've always approached this practice kind of threefold. Developing my meditation practice, the study, and then the reflection. And I found that even though this is a difficult sutta, I so quickly relate it to things that have happened before.
Mm-hmm.
And the work you put into it, the effort you put into it, does teach you as much as what's not necessary.
Yeah.
And the stripping away of associations that aren't conducive to this practice.
Yep.
So, and again, it's what you learn from Sangha members and good teachers and the Dhamma. And,
yeah.
And every day, you know, you're encouraged to come and see for yourself.
Yeah.
It's, you know, so I encourage anyone, and it's almost like the radio show that you're on. It doesn't do it justice. I wonder if she really appreciated what you were saying.
I think she did.
You hope that she can like take it a step further and see that it's great for golf, but there's so much more. You know, and can they truly see that in just a 15-minute discussion versus coming here on a weekly basis and listening to you three times a week? It's just, it's important stuff. It's good stuff.
Yeah. It is. Thank you for your kind words too. I think if I didn't really read the suttas from the point of view of understanding how the Buddha taught, I'd probably be in a constant state of disappointment. But I'm not. You know, I wish that everybody that came here got it and stayed and told others about it. Not, but all that we can do is awaken, you know, and do our practice. The rest of it is grasping after. It's actually a denial of the First Noble Truth to think that I should be able to reach everybody, and you know, it just doesn't work that way. But it sure would be nice, wouldn't it? It really would. And just to touch on that, we were on for a little over an hour yesterday because it had a guest that didn't show up. And there,
what station?
WDVR.
Oh, who was the interviewer?
Claudine Wolk and Andy Kim.
Mm-hmm.
It's a regular show that they have, a live talk. I can't remember the name of it. But they were both very, very good interviewers and very respectful. I was on a couple of radio shows, and because of their own ignorance, they were almost mocking the things that I was saying. But they were very open, very supportive. Claudine actually, she was part of an interview we gave a year or so ago,
mm-hmm.
and she came to a class or two, and she really enjoys what we're doing here. So it was fun. It's always fun when we do that.
Well, I guess along with what David just said is that if all it were to, you know, improve your life and your daily interactions and your business outcomes and your business relationships, then you could just like get on and off the path and come back and visit whenever you wanted, Christmas, Easter, wow.
The light switch on and off.
Yeah.
Right. And I think what David's saying is so much more than that. And through that right effort, like what Ram was saying, to continue to drive and build on all that.
Yeah.
That can't be all it is.
Yeah.
Right, that's the path to awakening, but you won't get beyond that if you're just reaping satisfaction from early new behaviors and new responses of life, because that's still all self-referential.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, it takes kashanti, patient forbearance too. You know, you gotta keep going. And if you think, I think many people get to the certain point where they realize that meditation is just too boring, and they don't really like listen. And some of the things that I say, I know you have to think pretty hard about it. I try to present it in a way that's easy to assimilate, but I know it's not.
Mm.
And that can be pretty frustrating for people too. But like David, he's such a good example, but all of us, that with commitment, and you, when you actually put the time in, you keep going, the benefits are, they're you can't even describe them. It's not that they're mystical, they're so entirely practical that it changes everything. David, I think you would agree with that, wouldn't you, David? Not to put words in your mouth.
I mean, I really took an intellectual immersion approach, but also I understood that you couldn't just do that. I really just took to it with a three-prong approach, knowing that I think the first time I met you, I said, I can't develop concentration any faster than a person can develop concentration, and but I could put effort in, and everyone can do that.
Yeah,
it truly is the one thing that you have control over. Sit twice a day, read a little bit, and truly try to, you know, like you said, while you're getting to that final, you know, awakening, show restraint, and, you know, follow the precepts, and, you know, this is, and it's the most ordinary thing in the world. It's, there's nothing extraordinary about what the Dhamma is. It's totally ordinary.
And like the sutta, because it addresses the ordinary. It doesn't try to overstep it or glamorize what is ordinary. This is what it is.
The worst thing that ever happened was that they made it a mystical
religion.
Jumping through hoops, I have to be psychic, religious, spiritual thing. It's so much more than that. It truly is.
Yeah, and it's interesting, but that desire is the desire that results in that mystical way or the creating religion is because they want it to be more. That's even what the Mahasanghikas did 300 years after the Buddhas. They wanted something more. That's an aspect of self-reference. A self-referential ego personality can never be satisfied. It has to be more. So even within my religious practice, it has to be more. It has to be more. I have to find a way to establish myself.
Well, and create those levels of exclusivity.
Yeah.
Which then creates a hierarchy, which then goes into control and, you know, limiting people's ability to achieve awakening.
And all that is so prevalent
today.
It's
all judgment.
Yeah.
And corruption.
Oh, there's awful corruption. But there is physical and sexual abuse of people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, and it's done in the name, just like in the Catholic Church. It's in the Buddhist religion too. And it's all
try to make power, incorporate power into it.
Yeah, and it's established in that hierarchical.
Power.
I'm not going to say the person's name, but there's a very famous woman practitioner who was just accused of sexual misconduct with one of her students, and her response was kind of like what we've heard. Well, you don't believe her. How could you believe someone like that? And what it did instead, and it's obvious that it took place. It's just one of those things you kind of know it. And I don't really want to go there, but all of the struggles, whether it's within modern Buddhism or within the world, could be alleviated by the cessation of ignorance. Will it be? I don't think so. But if I thought so, I would be calling the Buddha a liar. Dukkha occurs. As a consequence of having a human life, there's going to be suffering. What can I do about it? And the Buddha didn't just dismiss that we all have to suffer, but he did teach a way that we could all individually stop sticking the second arrow in. And if we would learn how to do that, enough people did, there really would be peace on earth without me really having to do anything except wake up. Really, I mean, it literally is the truth. I can't make anybody else awake. And I mean, I'm so fortunate to have this position, and we are also fortunate to have a sangha that actually supports awakening and not getting distracted. But we all got to do it ourselves, don't we? I mean, you're fortunate. You happen to have the world's greatest meditation teacher.
He's also the greatest baker.
The greatest baker. You know, the truth is, I can make apple pie, but that's about it. We don't encourage each other's eye making here, do we? In any way, and that really is remarkable. It really is, because most of the places I've been around. The hierarchical places, there's a sutta that I'll probably give Saturday or Tuesday, and I'm going to do it twice, where the Buddha talks about the getting yourself up, dressing yourself up in fancy robes and shaving your head, and that doesn't make you anything. Because it was common during his time, too. And I was at so many places where people that were not so loving and compassionate, but they dressed well, you know, and that seemed to be the most important thing. And these ornaments, and you think back to the Buddha, he could have worn at least silk robes, would have been a lot more comfortable than the rags, but to the day he died, he was happy with just robes made out of rags, you know, not for any other reason, not to prove that he was anything except that was just good enough. Why think about anything else? You know? Well, anyway, Bonnie, good to see you tonight.
See you too. Thank you for tonight. Sure. Right.
Thank you. Helen, good to see you.
Thank you. Good to be here. Some of the thoughts that came through to me tonight, so much of the choices we have are around what we engage in and what we do not engage in.
Right.
And someone else's stress is something you can be dispassionate about. And so for me, it's sort of like panning out away from it, like having an overview of what's actually happening. You've sort of removed yourself from the situation and you can just see it for what it is. And then that allows you to be more subjective and hopefully more helpful to that situation. You can't help all situations. And then I also started thinking about the sixth sense basis and how we have eyelids. We can close out things we don't want to see. We don't have earlids. So we have to be even more vigilant about what we listen to and the sounds that we make, words we put out there too, because we don't have any defense in our ears. And then I also started thinking about the voids, the empty spaces, and the importance of the empty spaces. And I heard an expression, maybe here, but something about anger only burns the vessel that it's in. So the anger that we hold does the most harm to us, or any of the
hurts. I was with you. I don't remember where I heard that, though.
It was a very poignant statement. And it, you know, you can put a lot of things in that vessel that can be good or bad or harmful to yourself. So I think it's really important the things we hold, the things we put out there through our openings, and how we view it all in a proper perspective. And then if you can do those things, there's a level of peace for not engaging in the wrong things or being the source of someone else's pain or anger.
Thank you, Helen. The sage of peace.
Yes.
That was wonderful, yeah. Okay, that was, this really was really one of the most significant suttas. I think I mentioned to Matt at the beginning of the year, I kind of laid out a loose curriculum of things that I'd hope to get to. There's one or two more suttas that I'll probably teach before we start the Truth of Happiness, but we covered such an incredible amount of material this year, and it's because your understanding can support this. You heard me say, I don't believe in advanced teachings at all, but I do know that it takes an understanding of the proper context to utilize these things. And you know, we covered some remarkable stuff on the restraint and the jhanas and what the Buddha really awakened to and how he taught, and then finishing this up with a clear understanding of what constitutes a person. What are we? Six properties, nothing personal. And yet, I would bet, just thinking back, you don't have to answer, but you can, just 1 year ago, that you have a much greater understanding of what a person is today than you did in December of 2017. Isn't that remarkable?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm really, you know, I'm not trying to overemphasize it, but to really know what we are and what we're in.
And what we're not.
And what we're not. It's just as important.
Yeah,
all those things that I thought I had to be just caused more confusion and suffering. I'm so glad I got rid of them. I'll let them go. Mm-hmm. Well, this is the last Tuesday class, I think, of this year, isn't it? So I am going to start, it won't be a class Tuesday, out next Tuesday. I will be giving a Thursday talk and a Saturday class on both Saturdays. Our first Tuesday class of the year will be on January 1st. I think I'm going to start the Truth of Happiness course on the second or third Tuesday, and I'll put that out in an email soon just so everybody knows, because there are two suttas that I'd like to get to before we start the course again. But, I think we'll finish with metta, as we always do. And I hope everybody has a wonderful holiday. So again, find your relaxed meditative posture. Gently close your eyes, gently close your mouths, and take a moment to become mindful of the sensation of breathing in your body, your in-breath and your out-breath. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward, and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a remarkable class tonight. Peace. Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.